Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Have a good week. Have a good week. Have a good week. It is Sunday, which means it's time for the front three with me, Adam Bowe, with the one and only Lawrence McKenna.
Yo, yo.
Chris Hennage is here as well.
Hey.
And Dave is here for the first 10 minutes at least, because, Dave, you don't have internet connection right now. Why is that?
I don't know. I'm living in poverty at the moment, Adam. I've just moved house, and unfortunately the internet line has not been sorted out yet, so I'm in and out. I've got fun at the moment, and it's just one of those things that sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad. Very similar to Manchester United this season.
We're now dialing you up through the ancient magic of your phone, essentially, and somehow recording it. But that's modern technology, guys. But anyway, Dave's going to be joining us for the Man United chat, of course. The big game this weekend, Chelsea-Man United. We're also going to be talking Man City, Southampton, all the other Premier League fixtures. We're going to be going around Europe as well and giving you a little update on some of the results and storylines there. And also looking ahead to, I believe it's called the EFL Cup now? They've rebranded the League Cup too. Some exciting games there as well. But while we've got Dave, there's only one place to start, and that is at Stamford Bridge. A bad day for Jose Mourinho, Dave. 4-0 to Chelsea in the end. Mourinho obviously returning to his former club, presumably with a game plan similar to that he deployed at Anfield Monday night, only for some individual errors from Daley Blind and arguably David De Gea, leading to a goal within 30 seconds, undoing it all, Dave.
Yeah, I think so. I think you've got to throw Chris Small into that mix as well, because if you look at his positioning, you look at how he shifted towards Daley Blind, then went away from Daley Blind, and how he potentially could have cut the ball out that came over the top. I think he's definitely thrown into the mix there. You know, individual errors really cost United, especially in that first half. You know, again, the corner, Chris Smalling switches off again. He has a moment to you know, clear it, but he stops looking at the ball. It's very strange from Chris Smalling. I just think this potentially identifies that there are some of these Man United players that aren't good enough to win a Premier League, and hence Man United are only going to progress when the replacements are bought, or there's some young players coming through the youth team that could replace them. I think this is a real test for Manchester United, and they've not passed it at all. They played well against Liverpool, but you know, the whole game against Chelsea, they were very, very poor.
But the point is, when they try and match up, Dave, I mean, when they actually try and match up with the team, and I don't mean sit six men behind a ball and then, defend, then they were not up to scratch at all. And I mean at all.
But they did what they did go into defend. The issue was they conceded an early goal, which blew away the game plan. The plan was very simple. They were going to go, 4-5-1. They were going to pack midfield. They were going to make that bank at six again, and they were going to have three midfield to deal with Chelsea's runners and Chelsea's men in midfield. It was a simple game plan. The game plan potentially would have been effective if they hadn't conceded that first goal. But a lapse in concentration again from Daley Blind. You know, the second time in a big game, the first one Man City could have cleared the ball for their first goal. And again, he's had a bit of an issue dealing with Pedro. You know, he makes a mistake of being behind the centre-backs. You know, when the ball comes, he then loses his man, doesn't, make an effort to really stay with him, completely loses him again. It's poor, poor defending. And again, Luke Shaw has to be back in the team for the game midweek, 1,000%. It's just not good enough. And then Eric Bailly, that's a massive blow. Hearing from the media, so it's not looking good for United at the moment.
I mean, Chris, Dave's talking there about how that early goal did offset Manchester United's game. Chelsea sort of picked them off in the second half on the counter. But in terms of their performance, I mean, they look fresher. That may well be the lack of European football that's benefiting them in the league. But they're looking impressive under Conte. We spoke last week about the success he's found setting up under this 3-4-3 formation. And it's now three wins in a row in the Premier League without a single goal conceded.
Yeah. I think the thing that concerns me about this is that Man United were undone by a team that really, I don't think, got into full gear.
I think Chelsea were impressive in moments, but not consistently. And I don't think they had to get out of maybe even second gear to really overcome Man United. They were very easily dispatched. And a lot of the defending, a lot of the just understanding between the players was nowhere near the level of a team that wants to achieve what they want to achieve. If anything, it was around mid-table, I would argue. That's where you would expect a team that plays like that to finish. And yet, this has been the summer in which they've broken so many records financially and with transfers and all this kind of stuff. So it does feel a little bit like the bubble has deflated. I'll be curious to see, or curious to hear actually, what Dave thinks of it all relative to the rest.
I'll set it up in case Dave didn't hear that. I mean, Dave, Chris makes an interesting point there. I mean, the Chelsea fans themselves were thinking, you're not special anymore, Jose Mourinho. You're only 6 points off the top at the end of the day. But seeing the way Chelsea are performing under Conte, seeing the way City started under Pep, albeit, you know, less so in recent weeks. I mean, Dave, are you worried at all about Manchester United?
No, there's a number of players that need to bed into the football club, Paul Pogba included. You know, he's a player of extreme talent. Written off, you know. Go back and watch any of his games in his first 10 for Juventus last season and then watch the remaining 28 that he played after that, and you'll see a different player, a player that needs confidence and a player that's not potentially fitting in at the moment. You know, it doesn't suit a two and was played in a two, you know, from the whole second half onwards. Didn't do enough in a three, failed to create a chance in the game, but still, he has talent. And it's one of these things with the English media, and especially Man United fans, is getting pretty negative on Twitter with Paul Pogba, and that's not going to help anything for Man United fans to start attacking him as well as the rest of the media. They should be getting behind him, but he needs a run of good performances, and I think that'll come. It's just adjusting to a new life, but it's also Mourinho tinkering with the system. I think if United had played the system they played against Liverpool, if they'd gone with a 4-4-1-1 with Pogba off, Zlatanu, Rubic, they would have had more luck in the game. You know, they did go for with Herrera sitting and then the two central midfielders ahead of him, and that didn't quite work at all. You know, I understood it in terms of how they want to press Conte and Conte and Matic, but gave United nothing on the counter-attack with the wide forwards tracking back. They had no outlet. With Pogba against Liverpool, they had an outlet there. You know, United hit him 11 times from the back with long balls, and he won seven of those aerial duels. So that's a big thing compared to having no outlet. Last time, again, he was on the peripheral of the game, didn't have a good game at all. He's another player that needs to up his performance and start getting back to the form of the start of the season. But it just collectively wasn't good enough for United. I think there's, you know, defensively, they were poor. Flame looked knackered as well. Flame looked like he'd, you know, run a marathon before today. So it's confusing that maybe the team selection was a little bit wrong considering how, you know, they play midweek, they play Liverpool on Monday night. You know, maybe some fresh blood needed to be in there. You know, the likes of Anthony Martial would have been perfect to run at Chelsea's back three, and that's something United didn't do enough, was attack the two outside centre-backs. And it was so frustrating because that's how you get at a back three, is you pull them wide, you dribble at them, you be very direct against them. And United could have done that. They could have just left three players up top. They could have left Rotan, Lingard and Rashford up top and broken that way if they wanted to set the midfield up like they did. And that was the confusing thing. There was too many different thoughts from Mourinho when, you know, he didn't really stick with one thing. There were so many different things going on with his system that he kind of forgot that we need to score a goal there. You know, we're not going to win a game of football without scoring a goal. I think that's something that he's definitely got to address. But there's definitely a solution there, and that's Henrik Mkhitaryan. And I think he'll, you know, as soon as he's brought into the side and as soon as he can get to, you know, get back to his form of last season, then United have a real asset. You know, again, Lingard and Rashford, they didn't do enough on the ball. And if they're playing wide midfield for Man United, you've got to do a bit more than they did. You know, Lingard is a wonderful player, but he's a player that isn't going to pick the ball up and deep and drive and take people on. And that's exactly what United needed. And Rashford is, you know, last few games, he's looked very poor out wide. He's not done anything with the ball. He's looked across far too early, whether that is an instruction that he's got. But he doesn't have the best delivery. And what I like to see him going is to the byline, but he seems to be hitting like the fullback area outside the box and just crossing it. So it's all confusing at the moment for Man United, and they definitely need to work on it, especially in the final third.
Individual mistakes and potentially some mistakes from Mourinho though, Lawrence. Obviously, he was the focus today, none more so at the end of the game, where he seemed to take exception to Antonio Conte's celebrations for the fourth and final goal. He approached the Chelsea manager at the end of the game, and in Italian, is reported to have said, "It's my opinion, but you do it at 1-0, not at 4-0. That's humiliation for us," in reference, of course, to the celebrations.
I found that interesting. I would have gone the other way around. I think Mourinho is there looking to draw attention to himself. I think Mourinho is showing how fragile Maybe he is, and maybe at times Manchester United have been in recent years. One thing that was very clear under Sir Alex was that they were a robust side. They had robust players in there. Almost, I don't want to say they're not idiots, but I mean people who are very sort of not stupid, but not the cleverest of guys. Or people who are clever enough to realise when to be robust. And I think United do lack a few characters like that at the moment. Mourinho's trying to draw attention away from that. Because essentially, if you did it at 1-0, you may be celebrating a win too soon. And if you do it at 4-0, I also think maybe Mourinho is totally thinking about it from a Manchester United perspective. Whereas actually, he's a manager away from home, and Chelsea are the hosts, and they can pretty much do whatever they want.
But that's what I mean in terms of, you know, some people have said it was a distraction tactic from...
No, absolutely, it absolutely is. There's no way it isn't. I mean,
but you not think he was really... it seemed to me like his irritation was genuine. I mean, that was his heaviest ever Premier League defeat.
Yeah, but I think that's him diverting. That's him diverting onto those. Yeah, but he's diverting onto that. I mean, it was his heaviest ever defeat, like you say. I also think he doesn't quite have answers for some of the questions that are being asked of him at the moment, or doesn't want to answer those questions publicly. And at the same time...
It almost gives him too much credit to say it was a distraction tactic. I feel like
I don't know if it's always a conscious thing for Mourinho. I think that very often Mourinho comes across as some people think it's a conscious thing. I think sometimes he's almost gone a little bit too far, if you like, into Mourinho-isms. And I think Conte's more than right to be able to celebrate what everyone's, because he's also got his own ideas and his own stories and his own relief there, which obviously Chelsea have been, I think they've been put through the mill in the press in recent weeks in London. So, I think that there's a great amount of relief around Stamford Bridge that they got a result like this, because I think pre-game they saw themselves as underdogs.
I mean, Dave, before we let you go, it was only in 2014-15 that Manchester United collected fewer points after their first 9 Premier League games of a season this campaign. I mean, it's not going great for Mourinho so far. We've, of course, got the League Cup fixture against Manchester City coming up in midweek. He's already said it's not a priority for Manchester United, but how are you expecting him to approach this one with the pressure on?
Well, I think we're completely forgetting that Pep Guardiola's had a pretty bad run of form as well, getting absolutely spanked by Barcelona and again drawing against Southampton in the Premier League in the early kickoff. Again, Guardiola was absolutely nutsy playing a 3-2-4-1 again. It doesn't work. It just doesn't work. 3 centre-backs with 2 defensive midfielders works at Bayern Munich, because one of those defensive midfielders was a full-back, so they just drift naturally back into the full-back position and they'd make a back 4. Guardiola doesn't have that at Manchester City, and he continues with his back 3. With them playing Sane and Sterling in the sort of wing-back positions, he's going to just keep getting beat, because Premier League teams are better than some German teams in being direct and pressing teams, and especially like Nathan Redmond, just cause them all sorts of trouble. But yeah, I think it's a big game for both managers. I think they're both under a bit of pressure, and whoever loses is going to be under even more pressure. I think Mourinho's done a good job since coming. I think he's had to change a lot of feeling around Man United. It's going well. I think, again, going back to the United fans, they've got a bit of responsibility here not to turn this into another Louis van Gaal or David Moyes situation. They need to get behind the manager. It's all about Mourinho at the moment, and Mourinho will turn Man United around. Give him some time.
I'm glad that you mentioned David Moyes, because Mourinho's now had a worse start to his Manchester United career than David Moyes results-wise.
Well, it doesn't matter. You're comparing the games that they played, the opposition that they faced, the away games they played. Played City, played Chelsea away, they played Liverpool away. I think it's all well and good comparing the first 15 games or whatever. But if it's not the same opposition, you might as well, you can say anything, can't you, really?
It's all relative at the end of the day.
It is all relative, but it does sound a lot like...
it's one of those great stats you can use to hammer someone with and hammer a certain team.
I could drop the Paul Pogba one more tackle than the player on the pitch against Chelsea, which again is an impressive stat. But then if you look at the tracking for the first fourth goal, it just completely switched off. One of those things, eh?
But I mean, I guess what my and I think Mourinho is very much a manager of results, and sort of claims that how he gets towards those results almost doesn't really matter when you have those end product. And I think a lot of Manchester United fans and a lot of Manchester United pundits also said that. And the difference between maybe Guardiola drawing against Southampton, which by the way is a draw, not a loss, and Mourinho losing quite conclusively against Conte, is that it's quite clear which direction Pep Guardiola's going, and it seems very much like Mourinho's in the woods at the moment with this United side. So the difference between the two managers is actually quite stark. It's that Pep Guardiola has got a clear management vision, and he's clearly trying to put that into the side, whereas this United side looked all at sea at different times. I mean, you know, it's all well and good people from outside the club saying
it does,
that.
But I think both managers have suffered for individual errors and players actually bottling it at the wrong time. You know, we've already mentioned the United players have bottled it. We can add, you know, to that we can add John Stones, and then we can add Kolarov midweek. You know, if these players didn't mentally have a little bit of a block or a massive lapse in concentration, both managers would have different results. I think that's a big thing.
Yeah, it would just be 2-0 to Chelsea.
Well, it potentially wouldn't be 2-0, because that's the thing. You know, when you lose that first goal, your mentality has to completely change, and that's a big thing. And the second goal was a concentration thing, and then the third and fourth goal came as a result of Man United getting hit on the break. So that's the kind of thing in football. The first goal is massive, and because United's concentration in those first 30 seconds wasn't there, it cost them in the game, and it serves them right. Weren't good enough.
With that, Dave, we're going to wave goodbye to you. We'll see you on Wednesday after the United City game, where I'm sure we'll be talking about Mourinho and Guardiola then.
Sweet.
See you later. I'll see you in a bit.
Bye.
There he goes.
You enjoyed doing that. Dave O'Brien.
I mean, I've got to admit, some of what Dave said, all of what Dave says there is right. It's very difficult. You don't ever really want to argue against Mourinho or Manchester United, because it would be silly. But at the same time, there were shades of full-time devils there. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I think you raised a good point in terms of Manchester City drew 1-0 at home. Yes, they're going for a run of 5 games out win, but I think the measure of the two runs that both teams run are different. In terms of 4-0 against his former club, is always going to be an embarrassing result for Manchester United. But I mean, talking about Manchester City, there, before we come on to Guardiola and some of the problems that he's having at the moment, let's focus on Southampton, because we always focus on what, you know, the favourites got wrong. But in terms of the Saints, Chris, I mean, Claude Puel got it spot on today. I mean, they've been very impressive. Shaky start, 2 points from 4 games, but now unbeaten in their last 5. And they're now 8th, just a point behind United, Chris.
Yeah, I thought they were quite impressive. I thought their performance, it's the kind of performance that you associate with a team near the top. And I think overall there's a lot of positives to take from it.
It was a mistake, though, at the end of the day that led to the Southampton goal. Lawrence, John Stones trying a back pass to Kompany, sort of some suggestion it could have been Kompany's mistake. The pass itself wasn't great, more towards Bravo potentially. Stones himself, though, has now made 4 errors leading to goals since the start of the season. Yeah. He's getting his own criticism, but do you see the fault lying with Guardiola? This insistence on playing out from the back, they sometimes do get themselves into trouble. We've seen that this season, and the fans themselves seem to be frustrated with the tactics in the first half.
No, I see what I mean. The fans, it is interesting. I spoke to another fan, Man City fan, on a podcast, who said that there is a sense of entitlement to all these City fans now, which comes across a little bit strange because obviously of what they remember in their very recent history as City fans. If they have very recent history as City fans, if they weren't those City fans in the first place, they might not have that context. But I think in playing out from the back, there are going to be moments when you make mistakes. You would hope that the players are of a quality that you would have players who do not make those mistakes, or their decision making gets to a certain level. That will change over time with young players. I think it's the same for, like Dave was saying, the same for Mourinho as it is with Guardiola, that drilling it into the players, the decisions that you want them to make, and then following through those decisions. And I think it seems quite clear that in the past we have seen that players have struggled or suffered in Guardiola systems because of some of their decision making, and then maybe not committing to those moves because they're unsure. Klopp speaks about it as well. I think a number of top managers speak about it now, is removing that decision making process, or making it as minimal as possible so you know almost automatically what to do. Klopp says playing from the gut is the almost the German phrase for it. I imagine there's a similar thing with Guardiola. So I think that he would imagine and visualise that he can coach that out of John Stones in time.
You'd be confident that he would do that at the moment. However, it's not going too well, Chris. They're stuttering a little bit. 10 wins in a row at the start of the season. As I said before, it's now 5 without a win. It's actually Guardiola's worst run as a manager since 2009. You could argue it's been a relatively tough run of fixtures, but still, do you think there's cause for concern for City?
Yes and no, in the sense of, you know when Dave said that stats in isolation can paint any picture that you want? I think that 5-game winless one is a similar one. They've had a fair few difficult games. I think the cause for concern lies in how adaptable his approach is to the current squad and their abilities. And I think there are certain instances where they're not going to perform in as well-drilled a way that maybe the Bayern Munich team or the Barcelona team of years gone by is. And that's going to be something he's going to have to try and work around is, does there ever come a point where he compromises his ideals for success and performance?
They are still top of the table, of course, Manchester City. To be fair to Guardiola, he withdrew Kevin De Bruyne, who's been the player of the season, arguably, especially at the start of the season for Manchester City. Brought on Kelechi Iheanacho, who maintains his remarkable scoring record. He's now scored 8 times in his last 11 Premier League games for Manchester City. It's 11 goals in total from 17 shots on target in the Premier League, which is quite something, I think it's fair to say. They are top of the league, as I said, closely followed by Arsenal, who remain in second place. Lawrence, failing to break down a resilient Middlesbrough side at home, drawing 0-0.
Yeah, frustrating for Arsenal because obviously they, early on in the season, Arsenal fans all say this most seasons and they get mocked most seasons. But I think there are elements of belief that, and elements of hope, I think also, that this is a side who will do well. They were frustrated by Middlesbrough for good reason. Middlesbrough played very well. They really didn't dominate the possession at all and managed to break very, very well. Arsenal went top of the league for a very short space of time, and Arsene Wenger's 67th birthday. And I think with the way that Arsenal have been playing this season, it was almost expected that they come up with a result like this at this point. I mean, if you look at the team that started this game for Arsenal, Theo Walcott started, Mesut Ozil started, both players, and Alexis Sanchez, obviously, all players who have been in good form recently for Wenger. You'd have hoped that they'd have scored a goal against the back line of Daniel Ayala, Ben Gibson, George Friend, and Barajan. So, and Victor Valdes, obviously, in goal. So I would say Arsenal have been frustrated here, but I think for good reason, because Middlesbrough played this one perfectly, and Karanka came out very happy at the end of the game, basically saying that he thinks they deserved a point, but not nearly as much as they did last week.
You couldn't help but feel, Chris, and I think I saw you tweet this out as well, they needed Olivier Giroud, potentially Arsenal, to come off the bench and help them break that deadlock.
Yeah, they needed a target forward, basically. And I got a little bit stick for saying that because some felt that I'd just criticise Arsenal. I don't like to give them credit. And yet, you know, I've said in previous weeks, when they play with Sanchez as a false nine, it works against high-caliber opposition. Excuse me. Because it allows him a load of space to operate in and try and unsettle the defence. Borough weren't really coming to do that. They were coming to not venture too far past the edge of their own penalty box. They wanted to essentially keep all of Arsenal in front of them, which was made easier by the fact that, again, Sanchez can only really run in front and I don't think is able to do something that spectacular with his back to goal. So at that point, you have to put someone in like Olivier Giroud, maybe like Mauro Icardi, who I think personally they should be trying to sign. Someone that's going to inhabit around the penalty spot area, that sort of position, because then it means that basically what you can do is you can start to put crosses in. And I backed up my argument with the pass map for Arsenal in the final third. And if you look, there's next to none, if no crosses at all. And in general, there are no passes into the penalty area. Now, some of that could be a slight trepidation about making that pass because Arsenal have a lot of talented midfielders and a lot of talented passers. I didn't see many who wanted to try and take that risk of just planting it in behind the back four. They wanted to find a really obvious route inside. And I just don't think Borough presented them one. I think, to be fair, Middlesbrough, they play quite well. The back line kept very straight, very organised. It moved up together, it dropped back together, and it just made it very difficult for Arsenal to play. And I think some teams in a similar position to Middlesbrough in the table could take a lot of lessons from that.
Yeah, I think I agree with you completely. It's always good to have that option off the bench, someone who's more direct. I don't think just because, you know, it's seen as a demotion that Sanchez is playing ahead of him, that he's necessarily finished, as some Arsenal fans seem to be saying. But I'm sure they'll be welcoming him back from injury, especially when they're up against opposition line winners, as you say, who are difficult to break down. Second, though, they are 20 points level with Lawrence, Liverpool, another good performance by Jurgen Klopp's team. They missed out on the top spot in the end, but it was a good win for them.
Yeah, absolutely. I was impressed by the way that Liverpool attacked in this one, especially the front four of Coutinho, Firmino and Mane, backed up by whoever, maybe Emre Can, maybe Lallana, maybe Henderson, whoever steps forward from midfield. It works very well as a system, but I think Liverpool will be most worried or disappointed that they didn't step forward from the 2-0 and managed to make it more like 3 or 4, so that come the end of the game, they weren't worried. There are some positives in there. There are some negatives in there. Obviously, Liverpool again concede from another set piece, which is disappointing for them. And you'd hope that they would have done just better at this point. And I also think when it comes down to the way that Matip play at the back, I think there's some real positives for him. I think Karius is still under question as a goalkeeper, but maybe that'll take some time to bed him in. It's clear that Klopp favours him at the moment, wants him to bed in better. And then later on, Klopp clearly made it his priority to sit back and defend the 2-1, which I'll be interested to see how Liverpool do that going forward. Chan coming out of midfield was, again, a great revelation. He feels like he can do even better in the next match. I'm looking forward to seeing that. And then Liverpool go on to play Tottenham next. So I'm pretty fascinated to see how that one goes, because Liverpool rested a lot of players for the under-23s this weekend, including Danny Ings, etc., Grealish. I'll be interested to see if Klopp rotates those guys in.
The other good news, of course, is that for Liverpool, depending on how you look at it, of course, Steven Gerrard's on his way back, maybe.
Good
maybe
news.
Not.
I'm not always massively excited by Gerrard coming back, because he sometimes brings back memories of just the old days when we didn't really do all that well. But hey, if Klopp welcomes him, then Liverpool fans probably will end up welcoming him as well. And
Klopp has said he's always welcome.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't really have much other option, does he? But yeah.
I assume most Liverpool fans wouldn't want it to be in a playing role. They'd rather it be in a behind-the-scenes role.
Yeah, I mean,
that would be a distraction.
I also just think maybe, that's part of it, is that, you know, Liverpool in the past have struggled from distractions that other ex-people, being that Shankly, etc., have sort of brought to the club, and Liverpool sort of outcast certain people. I don't think they want to outcast him, but I also think at the same time you probably want to have a good mix. I don't quite know what purpose he would serve.
He also couldn't do
gegenpressing, let's put it that way.
Yeah, I should say as well, this whole story about Gerrard returning does come from, you know, as many stories do in modern football, from his Instagram. He posted that living in Los Angeles and playing for the great Galaxy has been a privilege. The club will always have a special place in my heart. Thank you. It's not necessarily saying he's going to leave. Some have taken it as a hint. I mean, read into it what you will at the end of the day. But they had it. Gerrard could be returning when his contract expires at the end of next month, I believe. Liverpool, though, in third place. Chelsea in fourth after their win today. Tottenham in fifth on 19 points, 0-0 at Bournemouth, Chris. Some people criticising Spurs for failing to take advantage and to win this game, but at the end of the day, they came up against a very good Bournemouth side, clearly buoyed with confidence after hammering Hull last week. And at the end of the day, it took another fine Hugo Lloris save to secure the point, essentially.
Yeah, it did. It's very difficult for me to analyse Spurs at the minute, because I'd kind of focus on Moussa Sissoko when he plays.
You miss him so much.
Massively,
he made an impact when he came on. More of his elbow to Harry Arter's face than
Harry Arter's cheek, if I remember right. I have a belief or a theory or whatever you want to target it as, that at the minute, whether it's Pochettino or the players specifically, they're just not playing the way Vincent Janssen needs them to play. And they're just doing him absolutely no favours. I mean, there's a lot of, and I don't think they're the level-minded Spurs fans. I don't think that this is something that you're saying, Adam, for example, that Janssen is essentially the new Soldado. I don't think that is the case. I think he's getting next to no service and being asked to try and really make the most of a fairly few meagre opportunities that he does get. And it just surprises me that a club that has been so shrewd in the market sort of the last 3-4 years with the likes of Vertonghen and Eriksen and Alderweireld, and even Son, you could argue, bought a striker that they didn't seem set up to play to. Because he's not like Harry Kane. Yes, he can play the lone front role, but not in the same way. And it's a surprising naivety. Now, in fairness, there was the famous, what was it, 5 or 6 that arrived after Gareth Bale left? And there was a lot of failures in there. But correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think the same people are buying the players now as was then.
Franco Baldini's long gone. He was said to be the man behind those purchases. I think
so. It doesn't make sense. And I'm curious, as someone that watches Spurs a lot more than I do, if you feel the same, if you feel there's any credence to that, and how you potentially change it.
I'm not sure. I think he was an interesting purchase in that he was potentially one of the few strikers potentially available in Spurs' budget that they could go for, essentially. I don't think there were many strikers out there that Spurs could afford. I think he was a good option. I mean, we've all seen his scoring record in the Eredivisie. Of course, it doesn't mean it translates to the Premier League. He's obviously having confidence issues at the moment. I think most Spurs fans are treating him like Soldado in the fact that they desperately want him to score and they desperately want him to succeed. It was interesting in the Bournemouth game. Heung-min Son struggled, didn't really get any service, but struggled to impose himself on the Bournemouth team. When Janssen came on, he was more successful at holding up the ball, getting his foot on the ball, trying to lay it off. He didn't really have enough time to make an impact, unfortunately. But I think when he does get a chance, he seems to play well, but he's not having the impact that we'd like him to have. I think most Spurs fans are essentially counting down the days until Harry Kane returns, because, you know, at the end of the day, we looked toothless up front, whether it was with Heung-min Son, whether it was with Janssen. We didn't make any clear-cut chances. We didn't trouble Fraser Forster too much, even though we sort of dominated at the start of the second half. So again, another draw which cost us last season. Although we're undefeated, we've drawn 4 of those 9 games. So hopefully next week at home to Leicester, we can get back on track with maximum points against a side who have lost all 4 of their away games. I don't expect Vincent Janssen will start that game, but hopefully if he can come on in that game and get a goal, if we can win, I think that'd be a massive boost for him and for the team, because without Harry Kane, occasionally we do look like we don't have the clinical edge, essentially, to put away some of the chances that we do create. But Leicester, let's see if we can beat them at home next week. They managed to get the win themselves, Lawrence. They're now 20 games unbeaten after beating Palace 3-1 at home following their midweek Champions League win, of course. It's encouraging for them in the sense that, you know, it was a relatively comfortable win, although Palace threatened a somewhat unlikely comeback. But they rested Jamie Vardy, showing they've got a little bit of depth in that squad, Lawrence.
Yeah, I mean, they do have depth in some senses. I mean, I think that they don't have depth where it matters, which is in the back line. But hey, if you can outscore another side and stay up this season, that's probably one of the bigger goals for them. I think Crystal Palace have bigger worries than Leicester do at this point. Whether Pardew can motivate that team, whether he can get them to perform in the way that he wants them to consistently, and also whether his end product is what he sets out to achieve, let's put it that way. Because I think they can consistently try and put the ball on Benteke's head. They can have Bolasie or whoever else break through. But at the end of the day, I think they need more than that in a game. some games they'll probably win, but I think against more sophisticated sides they're going to struggle. And if they're frustrated, then they'll have real problems. I do really like the front line of Leicester, having said that. And I especially enjoy Christian Fuchs' goal, which it was contender for goal of the month. It's a really clean strike.
Lovely goal. Palace and Leicester then, mid-table, level one, 11 points, separated only by a goal difference. Elsewhere in the Premier League this weekend, Sunderland losing once again, Chris, 1-0 to West Ham. An injury time goal by Winston Reid, but there was an air of inevitability almost as they defended deeper and deeper, Sunderland, that West Ham were potentially going to nick it.
There was. I mean, the thing is, Sunderland had chances, so Wahbi Khazri had a really good chance just as the second half started. And yet, for a good portion, it was very much Sunderland holding on and trying to just... I wouldn't even say stem the flow of good chances as much as just try to win the ball back. That was the thing. In terms of the game and Moyes, I wouldn't like Moyes as my manager personally. I find him very dour, very uninspiring. He's just... There's nothing about him. I mean, you look at Sam Allardyce as a contrast. And you could debate whether they're in a worse position last season with the squad and everything and stuff that they had and opponents, etc. And there's a fairly ish decent argument to be made that Newcastle essentially kept them up. That it was a case of one or the other was going to go down, and Newcastle's own ineptitude kept Sunderland up. But then also there was that little few performances they had towards the back end of the season. They beat Everton at home. That was a good result. It was a good performance, more importantly. And I just look at the way that Sam Allardyce handles a defeat and David Moyes handles a defeat. And everything about David Moyes just feels like a rocket ship captain on a one-way ticket to the sun. There's like an inevitability about doom that just seems to follow him whenever he talks.
I just can't help but feel sorry for David Moyes.
Why? Because he took the job, though. I don't understand the feeling of... He took the job, knew what exactly he was getting himself into.
Maybe I think he did sort of come in and sort of go, whoa. You know?
Not pity in particularly the Sunderland job, and poor David Moyes didn't know what he was walking into. Just, oh God, ever since he left Everton, it's just all gone horribly wrong.
If he'd had any sense, he would have waited for the Aston Villa job. But then, in fairness, I don't even think he would have turned that round in the way that Bruce is. I think, honestly, he is a manager that looked much better 10 years ago when teams were a lot more cavalier.
That might be the thing, isn't it? That might be the thing. I mean, you mentioned Sam Allardyce there, though, Chris. There has been suggestions he could actually return. I mean, have you heard any rumblings about how genuine this is, or do you think this is something that could actually happen, or is this just a joke that is sort of potentially becoming reality?
It was suggested as part of a potential takeover by Chinese investors. However, it's very difficult to sell a Premier League club when there's no guarantee you'll be a Premier League club in 8 months' time.
Yeah, very good point.
That's the difficulty they face. Now, like I say, just to finish on Moyes for a second, you look at when he was at Everton, one of the things I remember he got a lot of credit for was the fact that he started to play like 4-5-1. He would have a holding midfielder and then four in front and then a striker. That kind of typifies his career. It's always been about containing rather than sort of overcoming.
Mm. Yeah, and now they can't contain or overcome.
Well, yeah, this is the thing. I mean, let's just for argument's sake, because again, there were some people that made the point, and I think there's some validity to it. There's a potential call for offside on that goal with Winston Reid.
Yep.
Let's just say
there isn't, though. It's not offside.
Well, let's just say that the linesman's feeling charitable and he flags and it's given a 0-0. You probably say that's a good point for them. It's a fairly decent result. And yet, now you look at it and you say, well, you know, they hardly really tried. So defensive and sort of limiting in the way that they played. And it's, to me, that's him in a nutshell, is that he's the kind of guy that, again, blames the players early on. I think I talked about this a few weeks ago. He went straight for the players early on, which I just did not understand, because you're going to need them on side. Mm. And now he's talking about potentially looking for sort of January salvation. I'm sure most Sunderland fans will tell you, them across the road try to do that with John Joe Shelvey and all that, and look how that turned out. There's absolutely no guarantees that it works. Yeah, it worked for Sam Allardyce. But even then, again, it goes back to that thing of how much of that was down to the fact that Newcastle were a disorganised circus of a club at the time.
It does also sort of, there is a feeling of inevitability, which Newcastle never, Newcastle did have that, but I think at the same time with Moyes, he almost allows the sense of inevitability to form around the way that the team's playing. It's unusual. Let's just put it, it's unusual for managers to go in and go, yeah, we're going down.
Yeah.
Even Phelan, put it this way, even Mike Phelan hasn't gone down that route, all right?
It's more positive than David Moyes.
Someone compared him to Villa, and I thought that's a fairly apt comparison at this moment. The difference is they've got time to turn it around.
And also owners who thought they were taking it in the right direction, although actually, yeah, sorry, that comparison works perfectly.
The final few Premier League games to discuss then. David Moyes' former club, Everton, losing 2-1 at Burnley. Bit of a smash and grab this one. Burnley winning to take them 3 points clear of the relegation zone. Everton dominated, but sort of simply failed to find a breakthrough, really. They're now winless in their past 5 games. Burnley, however, though, Lawrence, I mean, all of their points at home this season, all 10 of them, Turf Moor is going to be critical to their survival. Yeah. And it's a great win, essentially, for Sean Dyche.
A really great win. I think Sean Dyche said it himself that he was very proud of the win. He felt that they deserved a result in the previous week as well. And maybe he also felt they maybe didn't deserve this result. Maybe a point was more of a fair one. In a match that Everton dominated possession, they dominated shots, and they dominated a lot of the other chances as well. I think that, especially when it comes down to playing games at home, if you're going to be in what you perceive to be a relegation battle come the end of the season, then you're probably doing something right if you're grabbing a win at home to Everton. Next, they come up away against Manchester United, and then they got a very winnable home game against Palace, and then they go away to West Brom, and then they're at home to Man City, and then away to Stoke. So I'd say out of that, if they come away with 6 points at the end of that, and they'll probably be happy with that run, which will, you know, essentially I think is where they should be. And that'll probably still keep them above the drop zone because they've got some teams well below them at that point who just won't be able to catch up.
Swansea drawing 0-0 at home to Watford, Chris, still in 19th, but it's Bob Bradley's first point as Swansea manager, and he's spoken about improving the confidence at the club.
I think he needs to do that. The confidence at the club is a major issue. It's an interesting debate to have in football in general, though, the idea of how fragile is an athlete or a footballer's confidence. Because I think, you need to assess situations very well. And I think he has the ability to do that, which is important. Because there are times that, yes, you do need to show compassion and empathy to the players. There are also times where you need to essentially have a go at them. And if he can read those situations right, I think he can find success. But I don't think it's unfair to say that really confidence is a major metric for them or a major factor for them in terms of improving things.
They looked good at Arsenal last week, though. He made 5 this week. I mean, if you think they've improved already under Bradley, can you see them climbing up the table?
I think they've improved. I think I can see them climbing up the table. I think in some regards they may possibly take confidence from the decisions and the way he makes them. So, for example, he talked about in his press conference after that he picked, let me just pull it up. I know Alfie Mawson was one of them, but he picked the centre-backs essentially, or the centre-back pairing more specifically, with the threat of Audi and Ighalo, because he knows that Ighalo is a physical striker who likes to hold the ball up, that kind of thing. And Alfie Mawson has a mostly, if not exclusively, lower league history in the game. He's played for Barnsley and Brentford and Wickham and people like that. Now, I thought that was quite a shrewd move. Again, I don't think it's redefining the game. And a lot of people thought I was heaping needless praise on him when I tweeted about it. But I think it's a good way to read the situation and adapt to it. Now, there's a chance that because they got that 0-0, because they kept that clean sheet, the players take confidence from that. And they look at the fact that he's assessing the situations properly. Because a lot of the time your confidence can stem from whether the person at the top is actually competent at their job. You know, that applies not just to football, that applies to everything. I'm sure it's the same in your offices and all that kind of thing. So I think, yeah, he can definitely get them up the league. It's about building that momentum and continuing the slow steps. They just need to finish one or two. That's all I think that's really stopping them at this moment. It's all that stopped them against Watford was a decent finish.
Finally, Hull losing 2-0 at home to Stoke City. Things continue to go downhill for Mike Feeney and Lawrence, but things looking up for Stoke. Shaqiri's double lifting Mark Hughes' side out of the bottom three, securing back-to-back wins for the first time this season.
Correct, yeah. Although the way that Mark Hughes lines that team up sometimes does look like they kind of line up and hope that one of the players will do something a bit good, like Shaqiri did this week. Two fantastic goals.
Relying on that magic.
We did sort of say, I mean, Mark Hughes sort of said post-match, he does that in training, so we sort of expect it. And you're a bit like, really? That's what you go into a game thinking that's going to happen? Okay. And then I guess also with Hull, you say things are getting worse for Mike Phelan, but 2-0's not that bad. I mean, it's slow and steady.
Oh, I mean, right? You know, things definitely aren't getting better. That's what I'd say.
Yeah. They are, though, because, I mean, if you look at Hull's previous results, then...
to not lose 6-1 again.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you might get some entertainment out of that, Adam, but ultimately...
True.
I think,
hey, you're right.
You are right. I also think, though, you have to then look at Hull's fixtures to come, because, I mean, I know I'm looking through a lot of bloody fixtures here. They lost 6-1 against Bournemouth, but then I suppose it does go up and down, doesn't it? Yeah, in fact, look at it, it does go up and down. So it's gone 1-1 between Burnley and Hull City, then it went 4-1 to Arsenal, then it went 2-1 to Hull City against Stoke. That was in the EFL. So technically,
It just felt because they're at home and Stoke, although they were coming off the back of a win, they haven't exactly been massively impressive this season. It felt like that could have been a chance to kind of maybe stop the rot, maybe even if it was just a point. You know, because now, as you say, they've got they're playing Watford away next. Southampton at home.
No, they're not. They're actually playing Bristol away next. EFL.
In the EFL.
Yeah, so it's still a game, Adam. They're still going to have to field a side out there. That's part of the problem. Is I actually think it's going to be about endurance for Hull this season. I think it is going to be about endurance. They need to play their games and be very wise with where they try and get their points. I think a lot of managers speak about this when they're trying to stay up, and it's a very difficult mentality for a manager to foster, because you set a certain number of games aside that you think, look, we can win these, and then the rest are surplus points. At least some managers do that anyway. I think that the worrying side for that is that, you know, Hull are even going to get worn out in some of the other games because the intensity of the football. Maybe a few seasons ago when it was, you know, conservative draws in the Mourinho and Benitez era of football, when things were a bit slower and, you know, it wasn't the same kind of intensity of pressing, those sort of things. You could afford to do that, but it's different now, and I think it's hard for a manager to cope. However, they do have some matches that they can get results in. They probably can get a result at Watford. At Southampton, no question, but Sunderland, then they play West Brom, then they play Middlesbrough, then they play Palace. There's a good run of games there that they can get some points from and some results.
That is your Premier League review then, guys. That is the Premier League wrapped up. Next, we're going around Europe, looking at some of the big games.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Some of the big results from around the continent. To steal a line from Lawrence, let's go to Italy. Not literally.
Oh, very good.
So I do like that one. Guys, AC Milan beat Juventus for the since 2012 to close the gap at the top of Serie A to 2 points. Lawrence?
Love a bit of Serie A, and I'm a massive fan of Milan from back in the day. So I was really upset when things started to go down the toilet for them. They are now beginning to look like they've got a semblance of what they want to do. I think there's a bit of confidence around the club, but they're also still quite fragile in the sense that they're still not the same powerhouse that they were before. And I think they realize this. The new investment has sort of given them a bit more confidence and maybe a bit more stability in the long run. They can now go out there and challenge people at the very top. I will be interested to see how long this lasts, sort of how long Milan can sustain this for, because they do still have quite a few young players out there, and it was one of the young players who's bringing them forward that got them the result in the end. Locatelli. I don't know which way to say it, but I like it. And Chris was saying post-game, Chris, his reaction was just, it was quite sweet, really.
It was, and he basically said that I've scored a goal against the best goalkeeper in the world, and he just seemed in complete disbelief at what he'd achieved. And he was thanking his parents, his grandparents, all his family and everything. And this comes after he scored his first goal in Serie A. He broke down in tears afterwards in the post-match interview. So he's clearly overawed by the situation, but in the right way, if that makes sense.
Mm. Mm. And I mean, a lot of the credit, of course, there's been a lot of talk about the new manager, Vincenzo Montella's come in, and he's sort of brought through a few of the young players like Locatelli. Obviously, they already had Donnarumma. There's Suso there as well. A lot of talk, though, Chris, that AC Milan all of a sudden title challengers after this win. Juventus, though, of course, are still going to be the favourites, having won the past five in a row. I mean, do you think Milan are realistic titles for the Scudetto, or do you think we should be downplaying those expectations? Maybe the fans should be content with the rebuilding job almost that Montella's doing and be satisfied with these sort of performances?
I think they can take immense confidence and pride from it, because look, they've beaten a team that has dominated Italian football domestically for the last few years. I think in terms of saying title challenge and all that thing, I think that's where you kind of guard the confidence. And essentially, if you do sort of announce that, okay, this is our title challenge, I think that puts a lot of needless pressure on the group. I think in many regards, they benefited a little bit from playing with the freedom of lacking expectations. So keep fostering that. Keep approaching it as if you kind of didn't win against Juventus, and that things are still in a building process, and that will make it, I think, not only easier to enjoy the highs, it'll also make it easier to ride the bumps, which I think invariably they will face during the course of the season.
A big win for AC Milan, and I think, as you said, Lawrence, everyone remembers them being such a great historic storied side. It'd be great to see them, maybe if not challenging for the title this season, see them up towards that end of the table, because it's been a disappointing few years for them. Why don't we move on to Italy, why don't we move on to Spain, though? Because it was a big week, some big results there.
I'm not editing that out, by the way.
Thank you. Dad, sorry for swearing. Valencia 2, Barcelona 3. Let's start there, because as well as a last-minute Messi winner, essentially, a lot of controversy around this one. Do you want to explain why to those who may have missed it?
What kind of controversy are you talking about here, Adam?
There was a certain projectile that seemed to be thrown from the Valencia fans, who seemed a little bit aggrieved with the Barcelona players celebrating in front of them.
Yeah, part of it.
I thought it was quite comical, though. Obviously, I've never been hit with a plastic ball. I can't say how much it hurts, but Messi seemed to bear the brunt of it. He stayed standing. He seemed to be fine. Neymar got hit. He went down. Suarez went down.
Sinister slash quite comical. Because obviously you see sort of the more, how can I put it?
Dominoes. They all went one.
Yeah, they all went down. But then the more sort of the tougher players from the group sort of stay up, and then the Neymars and the Suarez's go down, and Mascherano is still quite a tough cookie. But
Messi was the one who had a few choice words for the offending fans.
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's going to be some anger towards Barcelona. I think Valencia are also one of those sides who see themselves as being able to compete at the very top, and I think they sort of resent the fact that they aren't seen very often there. But ultimately, I think that the whole point is that, you know, Barcelona got out of what was a very hostile atmosphere with a 3-2 win. And I imagine that Valencia will be dealt with by the league.
You'd imagine so. A good win, though, for Barcelona to come back to win that one. It takes them up to third in the table. They're 2 points now behind Real Madrid, who go top after being Athletic Bilbao 2-1. Atletico Madrid, though, Chris, losing 1-0 to surprise title challengers Sevilla. What did you make of this one?
I didn't see it.
Excellent. Lawrence, did you manage to catch this one?
I mean, I caught some of the highlights, yeah. But ultimately, I think the whole point is that Sevilla got away with the win. Atletico will be disappointed. There's too many very close results this season for Atletico Madrid. And, you know, as much as, and we've said this before on the podcast, is they need to be scoring more. Koke also will be disappointed that he got a second red yes. in 15 minutes. And also just that the changes of bringing on Torres for Gamero will be, you know, I mean, essentially Steven Nzonzi went and scored not just 7 minutes after that. So I think they'll be disappointed ultimately. Mm. And I think it takes Sevilla top of the league. That's the most important thing. And it's also that Sevilla are fast becoming one of the more interesting sides in the league because of what they're achieving. Again, on a very sort of fixed, small budget compared to everyone else at the very top there. And they are above everyone else now.
Sami Nasri, the revelation for Sevilla. Very impressive so far this season, alongside Steven Nzonzi. So it's quite a midfield pair they've got there. But Sami Nasri, arguably the most informed Manchester City player at the moment. Villarreal as well, winning 2-1 against Las Palmas. Did you see Las Palmas' goal?
I believe it was a good goal.
Kevin, you've got to see this goal. I believe it was scored by Kevin Prince-Boateng.
Oh, my man.
It was one hell of a boot.
Kevin Prince-Boateng is a person who in real life doesn't look real. Like, he looks like he's been carved.
Oh. he managed to score a pretty spectacular scissor kick, I'd say. But that was to cap off
a move
that involved the very quick short passes in and around the box, a back heel flick over the top.
Yeah, that was lovely, wasn't it?
So, yeah, probably goal at the weekend, but it is a contender at least. So that's how the league is shaping up anyway right now. The French league, we haven't talked about yet this season, in El Clasique. Looks like it wasn't much of a classic, 0-0. Between PSG and Marseille. I'm sure everyone's making that joke. Did you manage to catch any of this one?
No, mate, I don't watch French football because it's hard enough to watch. But well, French people. But it's still...
And even then.
Even then they're sort of going there with little streams of other things going on. Maybe a TFR live stream. Ultimately, the main reason we're speaking about Liga this week is that at the very top, it's not PSG who are top. It is indeed Nice, with Monaco second and PSG in third, 6 points off the top, and not even with the best goal difference in the league. So PSG are really struggling at the moment to get those results.
I mean,
Chris, Cavani missed a sitter. I can tell you that much.
That sounds like Cavani. Have you managed to catch much PSG this season, Chris? Because at the start of the season, Unai Emery moving there seemed to be such high hopes. Obviously, winning the Europa League 3 consecutive times with Sevilla, a manager of pedigree, almost taking a next level in terms of domestic football, at least, to take on PSG, signing Krajowiak. You know, despite the loss of Ibrahimovic, there seemed to be hope that they would be able to maybe build a more cohesive team, a team that would arguably be even more comfortable in the league. But it hasn't quite worked out that way yet, has it?
No, so essentially for the last few years with Ibrahimovic and Cavani, Cavani sort of asked, stroke demanded to be the central striker positionally. And for a long time, they just didn't indulge him. They did when Zlatan was out, I think, because, again, it was much easier to facilitate.
Was it?
And so in the departure of Zlatan, the thought was, OK, we'll now give Cavani that central role and we'll see what he can do. And essentially, it flitted between, yes, he scored some goals, he could be a little bit of a flat track bully now and again, but he also missed a lot of chances and was quite poor. And I can't take credit for having this opinion entirely formed by myself. Andrew Gibney, someone who does a lot on French football.
He's a good voice to follow, actually. If you don't follow him on Twitter already, then he does know his stuff about
it. He's got very strong opinions as well, which I kind of admire, because when you do that, you can often put yourself out to look a bit of a fool, but I've yet to see him look stupid about French football, which I think is a testament to his knowledge and understanding of it. And he's kind of said that, you know, Cavani's just not very good. He's not that elite forward. He's not the elite striker. And if you look at his numbers, that's kind of backed up realistically by chance conversion and all these metrics that we look at to kind of work that out. I think that's the problem, is that they presumed that Cavani could fill the void left by Zlatan. I don't think he ever is. I don't think he ever will. They really need, for me, a talismanic signing that is going to sell those shirts. And it's funny, we talked about, was it Rumorator the other week where we talked about Neymar going to PSG?
Yeah.
You look at him and you think, that's the guy that's got to be, realistically. And yet there's a large part of me feels like any talk of Neymar to PSG that is even remotely fanned by him is a great way for him to get an extra 10,000-20,000 euros a month.
I mean, to be fair, not long after we did that, yeah, we did it. He did actually get an updated contract. Yeah,
he played it well,
very well. And if anything, we aided him, so we deserve a cut.
Yes, yeah, we do. I think that's only fair.
I think he's got enough people demanding a cut.
Good point.
His dad probably gets, what, 60% or something? He gets a fair whack. But guys, that is how the French league is shaping up at the moment. Some of the big stories from around Europe. Before we go, let's look ahead to some of the midweek fixtures, because the EFL Cup is coming up and there's some tasty ones in there.
That's
before we get on to the big ones, let's start with Newcastle.
Oh,
Newcastle
United, insulting, Adam. Very, rubbing salt into Chris's wounds.
Well, I mean, the ones that are dominating the headlines.
Let's start with the shit ones,
shall we?
Yeah.
No. I didn't mean that at all, aren't you? Is it inferring?
Well, I'm not inferring, mate. I'm just literally taking your words and saying them back to you.
Chris, the biggest game midweek, undoubtedly, Newcastle United versus Preston. For those who aren't aware of how Rafa's doing down in Championship with the Toon Army at the moment, what's their form like going into this one?
Fantastic. The 30 million that we banked selling Moussa Sissoko to Spurs really helped. he's building a team, and I mean that both figuratively and literally. So he's managing the squad very well. He's making it so the rotation doesn't seem to come at a cost at all. If anything, it actually seems to keep everyone fresh. And if everybody wants to start, understandably. But then I think where it's also seeming to not cause any problems is normally that can destabilize a lot of players. Actually, it seems to be building an understanding between all of them that they all have a part to play and that they all have a role, which is, again, great. There's really nothing major to complain about. They're not playing, I would say, scintillating stuff for the full 90 minutes, yet they're producing enough that when they need that moment of sort of what I guess you would consider Premier League quality, they just do it. So they scored after a minute against Ipswich, and then they flicked between, couldn't find each other, and could put together some decent exchanges. And the next thing you know, bump, 2-0. Just as kind of there was even a start, sort of small inkling that Ipswich might start something. Bang, 2-0. Bang, 3-0. It's a very good start. And they've recovered from that poor start. I don't know if they'll run away with it in the way that some neutrals predicted. I think there's a good chance they win it. In fact, even Mick McCarthy said that. He said he doesn't think he'll play a better team this season. Which is a decent compliment.
Yeah, no, it really is. I'm looking forward to seeing how Rafa manages all of these different matches. It will be interesting to see.
Yeah, I think he's given everyone a lot of respect as well. I think, I mean, that's in keeping with his personality. But I don't think he underestimates anyone that he's faced so far. And I found it interesting. I was watching the Channel Five. Football League show, whatever its official title is, and they had Barnsley's manager on, and Newcastle just played Barnsley on Tuesday, and he said, kind of, you know, we threw everything at them and got nothing. So it's hard not to be buoyed by that and feel confidence from the fact that teams that are in good form like Barnsley, when you go there, they feel as if they gave everything and it was still a fairly cut and dry game in your favour.
Score prediction, Chris, for this one? Newcastle, Preston.
It's a tough one, because Preston
3-2.
Yeah, after all that.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, Preston had a cracking result at the weekend. There's no... And you look at some of the results they've had. They beat Huddersfield. I think they beat Villa as well. So they've beaten some of the really bigger named or the more successful teams this season. And Villa. So... Maybe 1-0. The thing is, so this is a bit weird. In the last round, they played Wolves, and they had just played Wolves in the league. The same applies again. They're playing Preston midweek and then Preston again at the weekend. So I would probably be able to give you a better prediction once I'd seen the respective teams and knowing how much each man's going to rest their respective squad.
Very good point. That is a problem with the EFL, isn't it?
That's too logical. Way too logical.
I think a narrow win, Newcastle. But again, I wouldn't. Equally, I'm not going to be surprised or cry if... come Tuesday night, it's 1-0 Preston.
Would be unusual if he cried. Yeah.
Not again, anyway.
Leeds United also in action. Lawrence, yeah, to take on Norwich City.
Yes, Norwich City in quite the form. Yes. When I say quite the form, I mean, sure. Yeah. what I mean is that when looking at Norwich this season, obviously they actually did lose to Preston at the weekend, which was what Chris was referring to, which is why it was such a good result. Before that, they were doing impressively apart from against Newcastle, which is why Newcastle and Preston are the more dominant sides in that league. I'm going to be interested to see, because also I think a lot of people have a bit of belief in the resurgence of Leeds, who obviously got a win against Wolves on the weekend as well. So it sets up both sides quite nicely. In this one, I'm going to go for Norwich shading this one, even though it is a trip up to Leeds. I still think Norwich will shade it because of the football.
There's an interesting duality between what I feel like I've seen with the fans as well. Some who... Guys like Talk Norwich City, Jack Reeve, who were
you were tweeting him on the weekend, weren't you?
Yeah, who weren't looking to kind of panic, and you know, it was interesting. He'd almost resigned himself to the fact that Newcastle won the league, and he thinks as long as we finish second, that's all that matters.
Yeah,
and yet I also saw Norwich fans saying, "We need to get rid of Alex Neil. He's really not very good."
Wow, which is unusual.
Bold.
It's unusual,
and they did spend a bit in the summer as well. That's the other thing, is that for all people saying Newcastle spent 50 million, they were still, I think, plus 30 million in profit once they'd sold all the wasters. Yeah, whereas everyone else had bought players with minimal sales. I don't think Norwich sold anyone of note. I don't think Villa sold anyone of note. And yet, they all spent a decent amount of money.
I mean, while we're in the Championship, we should also talk about Huddersfield as well, who also got a 1-0 win against Derby County on the weekend.
I really like Huddersfield, and I really like David Wagner.
Yeah, mainly because of what he did to Steve McLaren, who's now back at Derby, as we all know.
You know what it is? When he celebrates, David Wagner, and he comes on the pitch and all this kind of thing, it can be a little bit like, this is very classless, like this is all a little bit small time.
Mm-hmm.
But then you kind of listen to him talk, and you're like, he is an engaging character. You can see why him and Klopp get on.
Yeah. Yeah. That's partly what I felt. And the celebrations at the weekend, it could have been Klopp in disguise. Do you know, he was wearing a cap, he was wearing the tracksuit. It all looked very Klopp-esque.
Basically, yeah.
Yeah.
Speaking of Klopp, Lawrence, of course.
Yeah.
Liverpool taking on 3-0. Tottenham on Tuesday night.
Yeah.
3-0, you're saying. He's set to make some changes to the side. I mean, you mentioned it earlier.
Yeah.
Certain players who could be featuring. Who are you most excited to see potentially feature for the rest?
I mean, I'm quite looking forward to seeing Danny Ings, Marco Grealish. I think they've got a couple of other guys who have been rested in there who are maybe also recovering from injuries. I'll be interested to see who he plays in the back line, mainly because, you know, he said... I think post-match, or maybe on Sunday, after asked by a journalist, he doesn't have any respect for the guys who don't respect Liverpool's defensive efforts this season. And I think he does sort of struggle with those guys who criticise it, because it is also a process, obviously. I'll be interested to see Danny Ings and alike, and a couple of other guys who have been in the under-23 squad. Looking forward to seeing them.
He's been in good form, hasn't he?
He has, actually. And you know what? Danny Ings has never really sort of let Liverpool down in that sense, because he's... you know, he's obviously recovered from an injury. Gomez is also back. I don't know if he'll feature, but he's back in first team training now. So let's see what kind of squad Klopp puts out there. It will be interesting to see because obviously it's against another side who seem that it's almost like a mini sort of competitive derby between Klopp and Poch because both their styles of football are matched up quite nice and seem to come from a similar school. So I'll be interested to see what they do.
Yeah, I'm hoping Janssen maybe gets a start for Spurs. Maybe see the likes of maybe Josh Onuma might get a start. That'd be nice. But even if Liverpool lose, even if Spurs lose, I mean, it does seem again more of that opportunity to showcase the youth lines. I mean, do you care much about the EFL Cup, really?
I think a new manager will always think a little bit about winning some silverware, but I don't really care about the League Cup, if I'm completely honest. I mean, who, realistically, there are very few. It also finishes so early in the season. It's almost forgotten come the end of the season, which I find so unusual. It sort of finishes in March, which is what makes
I'm just hoping for some exciting games this week, essentially. Liverpool Tottenham, we'll see if that is one of them. West Ham Chelsea is a potentially fiery one. Lawrence, is this apparently there's some sort of, is this the first time the police are going to be at the game or the stadium or something like that? I've heard
the first time that police are going to be at the stadium.
A certain police presence. I've heard. Am I just making this up?
No, I imagine that is probably true. But I mean, it isn't going to be the friendliest matches, is it? And whoever wins it will come to
Delighted watching. To announce it's Kestrel Unit.
Yeah.
They're going to be inside the ground, apparently.
What a bunch of Kestrels.
Police have not been present so far because of lack of radio facilities at the London Stadium. But for this tie, they'll be able to communicate with a control vehicle on the stadium perimeter.
Adam, where are you getting this boring information from?
Sorry, I just thought it'd be interesting to tell you about the police staffing of the... Was it not interesting telling you the staffing of the police staffing of West Ham Chelsea?
Yeah. Adams follows police news.
Yeah. You don't follow that on Twitter, are you serious? Police_news.
Police Bible.
I'm definitely registering that.
Palof.
that is the next branch of the Bible.
At the Police Republic, at Police Daily.
Police 90.
At Police on the Street. Yeah.
Are we expecting I mean, of course, West Ham won the weekend. It was a last-minute goal, as we said earlier. Chelsea on form. We're expecting a comfortable Chelsea win here.
You'd hope so, wouldn't you? Just for the lols.
Just for the lols. Yeah, the final game, of course, is Manchester United, Manchester City. We spoke about earlier being, you know, a chance for Jose Mourinho to potentially arrest the poor form and relieve himself of some of the pressure he's finding himself under. Same, it could be said for Guardiola as well. Again, I feel like it's not a priority for both managers, though, Chris. And even if one side or the other does win it, I know that a certain narrative will be constructed, as Lawrence might say. But surely this is not a defining game for either side.
No, it's not. It's just a good laugh, isn't it?
It's just a good laugh.
That's essentially, it's one of those, I don't even know if there's like a phrase for it in English. Like, it's just a game to score mental points.
Yeah,
exactly. Hopefully it'll be entertaining. I don't really care about the competition, to be honest. I'm just hoping for some good entertaining games, some good young talent.
Yeah, it's the perfect time for it to come along for some of these managers, and also the worst time for it to come along.
I feel like this was the competition that Paul Scholes got his debut in.
It did, probably a number of players who got out there. I mean, you know, it is a good competition to put young kids out in.
Before we go tonight, can we just spare a thought for Victor Anachebe?
Why?
Absolutely not.
Chris,
where is this going?
To Victor Anachebe, can you just explain his, I think it's fair to call it a social media blunder.
What happened?
So Victor, in his infinite wisdom, must have been sent an email or a text from the Sunderland social media department saying, you know, tough result yesterday. Can you just tweet out?
I already know where
thanks
this is
for your support.
Great effort by the lads. Hard result to take, but we go again.
And he copied the message verbatim and so it read, "Can you just tweet out?" Thanks for your support.
Just says, "Can you tweet something like that?" I think he's tried to explain it away on his Twitter account by saying that he'd said it to a family member. He says he'd said to a family member, "Can you just tweet something like blah 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 blah?" And so he might be trying to excuse himself. It probably was, you know, I like to think it was him.
I like to think it was him as well.
Yeah, he's trying to blame it on
3210 or something and didn't have Twitter.
Yeah, I love that. That's fantastic.
Big challenge, baby.
Yeah, mate. Do you think you can just tweet you something? Put something a bit like, yeah, I'll put something a bit like, and then I'll put, what other word should I put? Wait, Victor, what are you typing? Nothing.
It's just like such an inoffensive, normal thing for football to do. Oh, tough to defeat today. They just managed to completely mess it up. He messed up the copy and paste.
Can we also very quickly mention MLS? Because obviously there's something big going on in MLS right now, right, Chris?
It's just finished. FC Dallas, IO Supporters Shield champions. Very richly deserved. I think we've played some lovely stuff.
What is the Supporters Shield? What the fuck is
that? Seattle made it into the playoffs at the expense of their fierce rivals, Portland, who actually are the current MLS Cup champions. And it's the first time in MLS history that neither the current holders nor the runners-up have made it into the playoffs the following season.
Little things like that where you come to this bloody podcast.
And Bradley Wright Phillips has won the Golden Boot. And can you guess who he beat out to do that?
David Villa.
He did indeed.
Bloody hell. Oh, yeah, you're right.
By two goals.
Oof, David Villa will be a bit annoyed, won't he? Be a bit annoyed. He'll be, oh, I tell you what, David Villa will be a bit annoyed. Oof.
He'll be vexed.
He'll be bloody vexed.
No, I think I'm a bit annoyed. A great achievement, Bradley.
Two seasons in a row?
Sure he'll be tremendously proud of that. And so he should be. That's a very good return.
Yeah.
24 goals.
And he's still not getting offers from other countries. But why would he want them?
Why would he? He's fine. He's doing fine.
Well, maybe he is getting offers and he's turning them down. I mean, it's a lovely lifestyle in New York.
It is.
You do think that. Why would you not want to go to New York and live there as a footballer? It must just be amazing. Because also, you basically live like an absolute baller because you've got so much money. But at the same time, you are known by relatively, and I mean relatively, few people.
Thierry Henry said that. He said one of the things he appreciated off the field about playing in MLS was the anonymity.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I feel the same about YouTube.
You've got, I'm sure you get, do you get notice more in the street now, Lawrence? Now you're on the Geordie podcast, is it?
Well, no, it's not the Geordie podcast. You know what is funny? It's less me. Yeah, it is actually. And it is, the funny thing was I was walking in Winchester the other day with my dad and a kid was walking down the street and he went, "Lawrence," and it wasn't the kid or me that suggested that their photo should be taken. It was my dad. He was like, you should take a photo. And I was like, "Dad,
you should definitely." I mean, it's I'm not saying it disparaging me. He's got, obviously, naturally he's got a big viewership, you know, he's got a lot of views and that downloads, you know. I just wondered if, you know, you get any asked for selfies on the street or if your dad's just setting them up.
Yeah, because now they can see you, you know. It's not like a podcast where here you have to go and look us up if you want to see what we look like.
No, that is a very yeah, which is always weird.
FYI, just type Ryan Gosling in. Yeah. And you've pretty much got it.
Yeah. Bang on.
I love the idea now that someone's going over to Ryan in Hollywood going, "Yeah, I love you on the front three,
Chris."
Didn't agree with our Chelsea evaluation though, prick.
Yeah, you do have a bit of a funny accent like that.
Guys, on that note, let's bring an end to this weekend's podcast. Thank you so much for listening to The Front Three. We're going to be back on Wednesday, of course, to talk about all the EFL action. Until then, though, Chris, where can the whole find more of you?
On my Twitter page, at KHENEAGE, and occasionally at The Front Three, number three.
Love it. A lot of tweets coming out from Chris this week under the Front Three account.
It's very good. It's good. They're good tweets.
They are good tweets. Lawrence, do you do good tweets that would be worth seeing for the whole if they're not already following you on
Twitter? I'm massive in the retweet game. If my retweets bang. So at Loscast, LOZCAST, see my banging retweets. And what about you, Adam?
Beautiful. You can follow me at Adam Boltwood on Twitter. You can also find me, Lawrence, and Chris over on the Football Republic on YouTube. You can also find us on the Front Free on YouTube as well.
Do that. You can also find Dave.
And Dave, of course.
And Dave, Dave Talks. And you know what is interesting is we're going to start a new strand of the podcast with Dave, specifically for Dave Talks. That's exciting news. That's just broken right here.
Wow.
Yeah, I know, right? Imagine that.
Seismic. What's
it going to cover?
We'll talk about that off the podcast. Yeah, fantastic.
Breaking on and off the podcast. Guys, thank you so much for listening to The Front Three. If you enjoyed it, do go and rate and review the podcast on iTunes. It helps other people find us. Until Wednesday.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Have a good week.
Week?
Bye.
Bye.